This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello, I'm John Elledge. Welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. New year, new intro. So, one of the things I wanted to do last year, both on Skylines and on the City Metric website itself, was to be a bit less London-centric. Talk less about the vagaries of London transport and, you know, more about the rest of the country. And I think I've been quite successful in that. We still do our share of City Tube stuff, but we went quite big on covering the mayoral elections. We've now got a regular columnist from Liverpool, a guy called Dave Mayo. We've got other people writing great stuff about Sheffield and Birmingham and Manchester and so on. But our remit is officially meant to be global. So this year, I'm going to try and go further. We're going to do more stuff that's not about the UK at all. That might be harder because our travel budget really doesn't stretch that far. But I can at least get interesting people to talk to me about places far from these shores. So this week, we're going to start by talking about Africa, and we're going to be visiting a country that a lot of people probably don't even know is there. Indeed, a country that, in some ways, doesn't even exist. There is one piece of background information you should have before we begin. This conversation was recorded a few months ago now, since when there's been a presidential election. So the guy we talk about who's been tipped as the new president actually is president now. And when we talk about last year, what we actually mean is 2016. But that's fine. You know, it's January. When you say last year, you probably still do think of 2016. So anyway, got all that. Then we shall begin.
I'm Nimka Ali. I'm a social activist and a feminist. And, well, I'm an African as well, so I was born in Somaliland and I was born in its capital called Hargeisa. So, yeah, that's me.
So the first thing to say, right, is Somaliland is not quite the same as Somalia.
No, Somaliland is a complete separate country to Somalia, but it did, for a short piece of time, join up with what was what still is Somalia and became the Republic of Somalia. And then he broke away in 91 and has been independent since.
Okay, so there's a lot of history to unpack here, which I wrote a piece on this a while ago, and it was quite fun because I know nothing about history from anywhere outside Europe, really. So it's quite fun to kind of explore this stuff. But, like, so let's go. So basically it all dates back to, like, imperialism, right?
We were a protectorate of the United Kingdom, so we were never occupied, which we were one of the only countries in Africa that wasn't actually occupied by Western powers or those people, I think, that Enlightenment started in the 17th century. So we were protectorate for over just close to about 140 years. And then we were given independence around the 1960s when everybody else gave up their land. So we became independent in, well, I think, June 26, 1960 is when we became independent. And we were independent for 4 days and then decided to join with our brothers over the other side of southern Somalia, which
was not part of the British Empire.
They were occupied by the Italians, so they were Italian Somalia, and we joined together, and that wasn't necessarily the most successful thing. So civil war broke out fully towards the late 1980s, and then by 1991 we'd kind of, like, you know, got back our borders and declared ourselves as independent, and we've been sovereign ever since.
So let's kind of unpack this a bit. Like, it's Somalis are like one people, right? Like,
yeah.
Kind of, it's the same language, ethnicity, and so on.
Not the same language, because the language changed with dialects. So ethnical Somali people live in 5 regions of the Horn of Africa, or close to the Horn. So there's Somaliland, which is the northern part of the Horn. And then there's the south, which is Somalia. There's Djibouti, and then there's parts of Kenya and Ethiopia, which ethnic Somalis are indigenous to. So all those parts got, like, you know, divided through the by the conquerors. And ultimately, some were occupied by the Italians, some were occupied by the British. Others came through, and ultimately when the UN was formed, the empire was seen as unethical. Somaliland became separate, Somalia was separate, and then Djibouti Djibouti, and then some part of what was the ethnic Somalis were given to Kenya and Ethiopia. So those are still contested lands, but ultimately Somaliland was different to all those because it was the only bit where the British were just having tea, I think having a picnic. They didn't really put any fundamental or foundations down at the time. But they did name it British Somaliland.
Yeah, well, we like doing that. Yeah, stick our flag in the place.
Yeah, you know, it's like Somalia, but it's the land of the Somalis, so it was British Somaliland.
I think the British was the bit we thought was important about that name, really, rather than that. But yeah, so, okay, you get to... When did the war break out? Like, 91?
No, the war kind of was like... It was there.
The war's already going.
It started to really go around 88, 87. So that's when I was there on holiday, and that's when the capital of what became the capital of Somaliland, Hargeisa, started to be bombed, because that's where the people that were fighting the dictator in Mogadishu were really concentrated there. And the main war plan was to kind of flatten them into submission, which is not dissimilar to what's happening in Syria and other places in the Middle East at the moment. So dictators do actually have a common war plan, which is just like bombing the shit out of places.
Okay, well that's...
It is, it's a bit like Damascus at the moment, as it was Hargeisa.
Yeah, no, sorry, I just slightly trailed off there because it's one of those things I kind of have no frame of... My standard response to most things is to kind of like, oh, I'll make a joke and move on. It's really difficult to kind of work out how to do that when we're talking about, you know...
Genocide.
Yeah, it's kind of a difficult thing to kind of be snarky about, and without a snark, I am nothing. But the thing I find interesting about... The reason I kind of got quite interested in this story, the thing I find interesting about Somaliland is it broke away... Since when it's been pretty successful, right?
Yeah.
Like it's functional in a way that Somalia, which is still quite war-torn, is not.
Yeah.
And yet it's still not officially recognised as a country by literally anybody.
No, it's not. And all that is all to do with the fact that when Somalia and Somaliland joined together as the entity that was the Republic of Somalia, their bank accounts became merged. So a lot of the whole thing right now is about separating the finances of a divorce, which is always quite difficult to do. But it hasn't been recognised, but they've been very successful. So Somalia has been under trusteeship since its basically government officially fell in 1993, and before that it was all to do with, like, you know, proxy wars of America or the Clinton trying to put other people in power and all those things. So Somaliland has been independent since 91. It's had elections, it has its own currency, it has its own borders, it has its own police, it has its own passports, there's immigration, there's taxation. DP World, which is Dubai, the United Emirates massive corporate entity, has
like a property fund, aren't
it's a property fund, and also, like, you know, shipping, all that stuff, has just signed a multi-million pound contract with them around their ports because they can import and export things. It has trade links with Saudi Arabia, so yeah, there's a lot of things. It's been doing very well.
It's just I just find it interesting that you have, like, one half of what used to be the Republic of Somaliland, the Republic of Somalia, is doing pretty well. It's kind of, you know, reasonably prosperous. The economy's okay and so on. But there's no official status whatsoever. I mean, like, literally no country in the world recognises it. I think it's almost unique in that.
It is. It's a bit, it is.
But the other half that has the official country status is a complete basket case, right? Like, that's, like, Somalia is still basically war-torn.
And we're very British in the sense that we don't like to boast. So it's one of these things that had any other country, like, you know, really got the things that we'd got, everybody would be boasting about it. So you can actually fly from London to Hargeisa, which is the capital of Somaliland, in under 12 hours. So it's 3 hours from Dubai or 45 minutes from Addis. So Addis has direct links to it. And so it's really successful. And I think one of the things that it needs to do, and one of the things that it hasn't done very well, it's about shout out about how amazing and how successful it is. In my social activism, has a lot of it has been about fighting FGM, and I think it will be
female genital mutilation.
Female genital mutilation. Not to just bring that in, but it is a country where, relative and same to its neighbour Somalia, has the highest rates of FGM. But it's one of the first countries that's able to take a grasp of it. And the guy who's tipped to be the new leader of Somaliland, which again, this is one of the things that kind of separates it from Somalia, is a secular person, and he's very keen to talk about the grip that the Islamic extreme has over the coast and has around parts of Africa. I think the commonality through how weak Africa has been in terms of governance is that whether it's West Africa or East Africa, like, you know, Islam or radicalization or even the Christian extremes have taken a massive hold on it. And he's one of the first people and one of the only people that would actually stand up to religious for fundamentalism. And that's something that I'm quite excited about, him talking about feminism. And Somaliland, like a lot of Africa, has a very young population. About 70% of its population is under 30. Half of its population is the same age as the country itself.
Yeah, no, the figures like that always... Well, they mostly make me feel old, to be honest, because I'd be like one of the older people there. So
you will be. I'm one of the oldest people. I'm 34, and like Uganda's population, I think about 80% of it is under 25. So
it's crazy.
It's massive, and I think that's one of the things about Africa is that it's so young and it's so vibrant, and it needs leadership that kind of can speak to that. And at the moment, a lot of those people haven't been speaking to that. So yeah, so Somaliland is this utopia, but it's also kind of a bit nuts, like every other place that I've been to, because it's all run by men, and the idea of feminism is kind of a novelty. But yeah, it's an amazing country.
This podcast, we're talking about infrastructure and why African cities have sometimes struggled to kind of develop in the way perhaps Asian ones have come on in the last 100 years. Like, tell me a little bit about Hargeisa. Like, what's it like? What does it have? Like, just from a, you know, the kind of nerdy stuff I like. What's it got going for it?
High-speed internet. It's got faster internet than the UK. So it's got 4G internet. And there's coffee shops. There's a buzzing, very middle-class community. And the weird thing about Somaliland and Hargeisa itself is that the fact that Somaliland is one of the only countries where... I think the only place I've ever seen that was Burkina Faso as well, where the fact that the level of poverty and richness is not necessarily that massive. So there's a, because the population's only about 4 million. So it's got a lot of young people. It's got a lot of, like, you know, internet and all those kind of things. It's got a lot of high rise, like, you know, buildings. It doesn't necessarily have the kind of road infrastructure that we would wish for it to have in terms of the way that it's kind of developed, but it does have television, it has everything that you could probably want.
It doesn't have like a metro network yet, does it?
No, it doesn't have, but it does have a bus network, which is one of the most complex I've ever seen in my life. So I haven't been able to figure it out. And it also has this, like, you know, its own black cab service, which is technically a Toyota Yaris. And the way that these have kind of sprung up is that a lot of the women, especially the mothers and a lot of the families, have been stopping their sons from, like, you know, leaving the country and trying to find wealth in the West. So they've kind of created a minicab service without necessarily thinking that they were creating a minicab service. So all these people started bringing these Toyota Yarises, which are nicknamed Please Don't Leave, which is the mothers begging their sons not to leave and go on these horrible journeys that we see right now on our televisions. But the thing about Western countries, one of the things that it's done is that Somaliland has picked up its architecture from the West. So a lot of the people have, a lot of its population live in the diaspora and have kind of come back. So the houses have been built very much to an American standard as opposed to an African standard. So there's an overuse of marble, there's a lot of shiny things. It's very Arab in its architecture than it would be African. And I don't necessarily think that really serves it very well.
The climate's too different.
Different, yeah, exactly. It's one of those things, it's a bit like when the walkie-talkie was first built and they didn't really think about the reflective glass
The death ray was...
Yes, exactly. You know, so
Jim Waterson, now of BuzzFeed, who's also been on this podcast, did a very clever story. We went out with a frying pan and an egg and proved you could literally fry an egg and the heat reflected off this building. Good for him.
And you could probably do that in Hargeisa as well at the moment because they're not thinking about those things. So I think what Hargeisa has is that because it's so untapped naturally with its resources and it's peaceful, it's got a lot of time to spend on money and just kind of doing itself up. So it's a little bit like a wife that's waiting supportive for her. Not like, no, I can say this because I'm a feminist, but she was a very kept woman, and her children still have a lot of money to kind of keep her kept. So she spends a lot of time on cosmetic surgery and doesn't necessarily spend anything on, like, you know, educating itself about its culture. And that's one of the key things. I think that's one of the failures of Africa is, and it's not a failure because of the fact that it's just happened by accident. I think the West has been very key in not teaching Africa and the African population about their history. So if you go to places like Mali or Burkina or even Sierra Leone, all these places, there are buildings that have lasted millennia, but people just don't want to look at those as things that we would want to keep hold of and actually maintain, where places in the West, they will be listed as historical places and get grade listed for protection. I think Africa fails itself in doing that. They've very much been sold that new is amazing and shiny is the way to go. And there's a lot of shiny things in Hargeisa, and I don't necessarily think that's the best way to go.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So, I mean, that's you were born in Somaliland, right?
Yeah.
You've been here since you were quite a small child, but you're still very involved in the diaspora. Like,
yeah.
It's kind of quite, the diaspora is quite active in the life of the country, right? It's not just like you leave and then you have no contact with it.
No, so about 70% of the country's wealth is from remittance. So the diaspora is very connected in sending money back and keeping it going, because if you're not recognised, then you're not getting any international aid or anything else. So basically, as soon as you get a job, about 20% of your salary is taxed to go back home, or if not even 50% sometimes. So yeah, ultimately, yeah, there is that connection. But you can probably find this in Nigeria as well, but it's the only place that you'd ever find, like, you know, a Hummer, fast speed internet, and goats just roaming the streets just sort of randomly. And that's one of the things that I never figure out, is like, how do you know who these goats belong to? Nobody steals the goats. It's really weird. So you'll see the presidential palace, and it's like, you know, it's got all the lights and all the glitz and glamour, and there's like just random goats that are just walking around it. And that goat goes home. So you might not find a metro system, but there are goats that know their way home.
Maybe someone should do a good map of the goats, then that'd get me interested.
Also, actually, do you know what? You can just put a GPS on a goat and just see how, like, you know...
That would be awesome.
Yeah,
genuinely, that would be amazing. No, but someone should do that.
But no, but it's one of the weirdest things is that these goats will, like, you know, go all the way down to the city. They'll hang around at the... I don't know whether I'm seeing the same goats or some of the goats look the same, but...
It's difficult to tell goats apart sometimes.
It is, but you can probably, like, you know, put a tracker on a goat and see how long it takes it, like, you know, where it goes around during the day, and just, like, you know, see what kind of, like, a bit one of those women that ran around and did like a penis thing on her Nike running thing.
We've gone from goats to penises.
No, but there was a woman that did her.
I think I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yes. So
yeah.
There was a woman that did rude things, like, you know, by running around London or wherever. So you could probably do that with a goat.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll look into that.
Well, the camels are more expensive, so nobody trusts.
Who moves faster, the camels or the goats?
No, the camels are protected. So basically, everybody kind of, like, a camel costs like £1,000.
A camel is a luxury.
Yeah, a camel is a luxury, so they're not really trusted to roam the streets. But yeah, but the goats roam the streets, they find their way home, they don't seem to get other goats pregnant. That's a more interesting way to travel around. And there was so I went in May, and by the time I went back in December last year, so in May last year, there was a few donkeys and carts on there, but since November they've kind of been outlawed, and there's a lot of cars, and it's and the really interesting thing about Hargeisa is, and Somaliland, is that there are no street names.
Okay, does that get confusing?
But do you know what? So you would ask, no, it's one of the weirdest things is that you'd say, so everything has a landmark. So so they'll say, like, former BBC studios. So there's the BBC studios, like White City. And it's called Ida'ada, basically, where the broadcast happens, or the broadcast area. And then you'd have to, like, you know, everything is, like, you know, by there. and about three streets down or whatever. So it's a city that's kind of springing up without any street signs.
You navigate by landmarks,
by landmarks,
directions from the landmarks.
Or by somebody's shop, or by where somebody was shot. It's honestly, it's one of the most interesting things. It's all... And now they have like new names in terms of different areas that are coming down. So there's like Little London, Little Beirut, Little India, and all these are the kind of places. That, and those are all named after people that have kind of come back from the diaspora.
Just we should be wrapping up in a second, but I just kind of wanted to ask first. You're very involved in sort of political activism here in London.
Yeah.
And FGM is a big cause for you, and obviously that's largely an African cause. Like. To kind of come back to where we came in, does it get frustrating that so many people in the West do just kind of think of Africa as if it's a thing rather than like it being several dozen different countries with different religions and languages and cultures and whatever else?
Yeah, and also Africa as the bud of civilization. So it was really interesting the other day when Donald Trump was talking about, like, you know, the end of civilization, and you're just thinking, what do you mean end of civilization? Like, there are countries that have been going on for millennia, and the West did not necessarily give us democracy or history or all these other kind of things. So I think, yeah, I do. It does, like, I've known Africa in several stages. So the whole point of the fact that I grew up as a very privileged young African, and then what happened was that in the 1980s and then the early 90s, the whole life aid and everything about Africa became that you had to be embarrassed and people were starving and it was about famine. And now it's kind of come on this new resurgence where it's about African music, African culture, African heritage, and people are really excited about Africa. And that's the Africa that I've known. So it's been really interesting that people are kind of catching up. And I think the younger generation, the diaspora, are kind of catching up. But I think it's more... I think... I'm going to say this very honestly. I think white men are very scared that they might not be the most amazing thing on the planet, and the fact that they discovered Africa.
I'm not scared at all. I'm fine. Okay. I'm totally fine. What are you talking about? Okay, I'm obviously amazing.
So this is the reality is that Africa was like, you know... When London was like dealing with the plague and syphilis and all these other kind of things, Africa was an amazing place where there was poetry, like, you know, healthcare systems and all these other kind of things. I think the Western conquerors came, and they didn't necessarily come to conquer with, like, you know, trying to give us something. They tried to kill us and enslave a nation, enslave, like, you know, a whole continent. And it was them that screwed Africa up. It wasn't necessarily the fact that Africa was, like, you know, a failed continent when they found it. So they found this place that was full of, like, you know, natural beauty and full of all the things I think they wish they had. And that could be happening again. And I don't necessarily think that the West is really ready for a rise in Africa. But Africa could rise. So we can sit here and talk about the failures of the African continent. But I think a lot of those failures has been through the prism of the West trying to see Africa as a Western state, as opposed to Africa trying to unshackle itself from all the bullshit it was given, like Robert Mugabe and everything else, and try to become a place that was full of, like, you know, real history and real, like, you know, culture, and a place full of beauty. And I think after we deal with extremism and Islam in the narrative that it comes from the Arab continent, I think Africa will get back to its natural pretext, which is something which is quite chilled. And interestingly enough, the largest population of black people in the UK now are of African heritage. So for the first time since I think 2010 census was the first time that the African became the largest number of black people in the West, as opposed to African Caribbean.
Yeah, and it's often like something I've noticed, it's on the other side of the continent, but something I've noticed recently is British Nigerians are an increasingly visible force.
Yeah.
And British Somalis as well, I suppose. You've got Samo Farah is the most obvious.
Yeah.
But you are seeing people from individual African countries kind of with those kind of links attaining a certain stature in a way that I don't recall from my childhood. There weren't many visible British Africans when I was a kid, whereas now I can rattle off the names of probably a dozen.
Yeah, and you can probably, and this is one of the things, is like they're probably, like, a lot of them are also second generation Etonians or whatever it is. But I think one of the things is that a lot of the Africans that came here, whether they were Somali, specifically Somali, Nigerian, or if they came from Ghana, so those are the three kind of strong indigenous to this kind of country, having the second or third generation, was that a lot of their parents, they had aspirations back home, or they had privilege. So they were able to come here. They took menial jobs, but their kids were able to go to university. So when I was growing up, that is the Africa that I knew. The East Africa that I left, or I was forced to leave, was more to do with civil war than to do with the famine that Live Aid wanted to kind of show. And the West Africa that a lot of the Nigerians and the Ghanaians know, it's nothing to do with Boko Haram and all these kind of craziness. It's to do with vibrance. And I think if you ever get a British Airways flights to Lagos, I think 50% of it is first class. It's like one of the largest. Honestly, it's one of the weirdest things. And the only people that are going, not first class, are aid workers that are going there in order to fly from Lagos to other places. So yeah, Africa is rising, and I hope that it's something that is celebrated, as opposed to that it's something that's kind of feared and kind of held down. And I do believe that there needs to be a seat of the Security Council for an African country, or a rotating African seat. I think that's when we know that people have kind of accepted Africa as the superpower, as it is, because even though it's not a country, as a continent, there's a shared history, and I think we have a shared knowledge about the fact that what it feels like to be undermined and to be undervalued. So in that way, as an African, I think I do agree to the pan-Africanism in that sense, but ultimately, yeah, we're not a country, but it's a powerful continent.
Well, I don't know if anyone from the UN Security Council listens to this podcast, but if you do, then
you never know.
Give us a call.
I might meet them at the Evening Standards.
Yeah.
you know, yeah, the Russians.
That was the fantastic Nimco Ali. So, what else have we got coming up in the weeks to come? I actually got another interview about Africa, which in fact I recorded before that one. It's not quite so positive about the region's prospects, and it's also with a white English journalist. That may or may not be a coincidence. Next week, hopefully, I'm going to be talking to Matthew Engel, the Financial Times journalist who wrote a great history of the British Railways, as well as a book about England's counties. I've also been a guest on a couple of other podcasts recently, so we'll be running the tapes of those as well. But the idea I'm currently most excited about is one that I stole from a travel journalist called David Whitley on Twitter. He suggested to me that there was an interesting debate to be had about which British cities would be the best if you're a tourist. You know, like I think tourists who come to this country, they probably know about London. I mean, they know about London, but they probably know about Cambridge and Oxford and Edinburgh and those kind of places. But they don't really go to Manchester or Leeds or Sheffield so much, I suspect. So, you know, I think there's an interesting conversation to be had about whether they should. Anyway, I love David's idea, so I am shamelessly going to steal it. And at some point, Stephen Bush and I are going to argue that one out, interspersed with brief clips from representatives of these various cities trying to sell them to us. I've had quite a lot of enthusiastic uptake on that one, but so far I've only actually had a clip from Leeds. So if you're keen to get involved in that, then drop me a line. Happy New Year, everyone. See you next time.